Hey, Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are wading into, well, let's face it, some pretty murky waters. We're talking about cultural appropriation.
Yes. It's definitely one of those topics that seems to generate more heat than light, doesn't it? People jump to conclusions almost instantly.
Totally. You get stuck in this loop of that's offensive
yeah.
versus people are too sensitive. And the actual conversation, the nuance, just gets lost.
Which is precisely why we wanted to dig into this source. We've been reading Cultural Appropriation by Peter Balint and Patty T. Leonard. They're philosophers tackling this head on.
And our goal today, really, is to give you a kind of shortcut through all that noise.
Yeah.
This book offers, like, a toolkit.
Yeah, a moral toolkit, almost. It provides a framework, some solid ground for thinking about these cultural interactions instead of just reacting emotionally.
A way to analyze, not just, you know, shout. So let's talk about the authors. What makes Balint and Leonard particularly suited to guide us through this minefield?
Well, their background is key. They're political philosophers. Peter Balint works on multiculturalism, liberal theory. Patty T. Leonard, she focuses on applied ethics, democracy, migration.
Okay, so they're coming at it with this real ethical rigor. Not just commenting on trends, it's about the underlying principles.
Exactly. And their expertise in liberal democracy is, I think, their superpower here. It lets them really carefully balance these often competing values, like freedom of expression on one side.
On the other, the genuine concerns of marginalized groups about, say, respect and dignity.
Precisely. They're trying to find where those values can constructively meet. Their work is actually part of a series called What Do We Owe Each Other? Which kind of frames the whole discussion perfectly. What are our duties when we borrow culturally?
Okay, let's dive into their main argument then, because honestly, it pushes back against a lot of the common assumptions. What's the absolute core idea?
The big takeaway is this. Cultural appropriation. It's not automatically wrong. The simple act of borrowing something from another culture is, in itself, morally neutral.
Right, that does sound pretty different from how it's often discussed. So if the borrowing itself isn't the problem, where do they draw the line? What makes it cross over from okay to, well, not okay?
They basically shift the whole debate. Instead of getting bogged down in fuzzy ideas about who owns culture, they focus on harm. Real, identifiable harm.
Harm, okay.
Appropriation only becomes ethically wrong, they argue, when it causes specific kinds of significant harm. This is crucial because it helps us sort out, you know, harmful acts from just normal cultural exchange or appreciation.
So it's like a filter. If there's no specific harm, maybe we don't need to worry quite so much. What counts as harm then?
Yeah.
They have two main categories, right?
They do. Two pillars, really, that define when borrowing becomes indefensible. First, there's profound offense. And this isn't just feeling uncomfortable. It has to be an identity-based violation, something that really attacks a person's or group's dignity, their equal standing.
Dignity, not just discomfort. Got it. And the second one?
The second is unjustified taking. This is more about exploitation. When borrowing deprives the source community of something significant, maybe material resources, maybe cultural capital, without fair compensation, especially when there's a power imbalance involved.
That framework feels really practical. Let's dig into the details. They start by defining appropriation carefully, emphasizing that power dynamic.
Yes, that's central. For them, appropriation specifically involves taking cultural elements by someone from a dominant group from a minority or marginalized group. And importantly, it happens within a context of unequal power.
So if it's reciprocal between equals, that's different.
Right, that's cultural exchange. Or if things just naturally blend over time, that's cultural influence. The ethical red flag goes up when there's that power imbalance in the taking.
And is that power focus why they aren't big fans of the cultural ownership or property argument? The idea that a culture owns a style like a patent?
Pretty much. They see it as, well, philosophically shaky and practically unworkable. Culture's just too fluid, right? It flows, it mixes.
Yeah, trying to draw hard property lines around a dance move or a pattern seems difficult.
Exactly. It could lead to stagnation, endless disputes. So for them, the problem isn't taking the thing itself. It's the harm that taking might cause, the exploitation, the disrespect.
Okay, let's unpack that first harm. Profound offense. This feels like the really tricky one, the one that gets misused a lot in public arguments. How do they define it tightly enough so it's not just about someone feeling slighted?
They tie it very specifically to things of sacred, spiritual, or deep historical significance. For an offense to be profoundly harmful in their view, the act has to be reasonably seen as communicating contempt or disrespect for the source culture's basic dignity.
The example that always comes up is the war bonnet, right? Non-Indigenous people wearing one at, like, a music festival.
That's the classic case. Because for many Plains cultures, that headdress isn't just decoration, it's sacred. It represents honor, history, spiritual connection, earned achievement.
So wearing it as a party accessory just completely strips away that meaning.
Exactly. It trivializes something deeply significant. It sends a message, intended or not, that the group's identity and dignity don't really matter. That's the dignity harm they're talking about.
And it's not always about fashion or commerce, is it? You mentioned the Kennewick Man case, the ancient one. That seems like a different kind of profound offense.
Oh, absolutely. That case was less about trivialization and more about denying identity. Scientists saw the remains as universal human heritage, data. But for the local tribes, he was an ancestor.
An ancestor needing proper respect and burial according to their traditions.
Right. And the refusal by institutions for a long time to repatriate those remains was seen as a deep offense. It was essentially saying, your spiritual connection, your identity as descendants, your traditions, they don't count as much as our scientific claims. That's an institutional harm to dignity.
Okay. That clarifies the profound offense side. Let's switch gears to the second pillar, unjustified taking. This sounds more focused on material stuff, economics, exploitation.
It is. This is where power imbalances and, frankly, money often come into play quite starkly. It happens when outsiders take cultural elements, commercialize them, maybe make a lot of profit,
while the original community gets nothing. Or maybe can't even profit from their own heritage.
Precisely. Or they're not asked, not credited, not compensated. Especially when that community is already marginalized.
The fashion world seems like fertile ground for examples here. You mentioned the KTZ brand case earlier.
Yeah, that's a really clear one. The brand Kokontazai used a design that was almost identical to a sacred Inuit shaman's garment created by Salameawa.
Without permission, without payment.
None of that. They just took it, put it on the runway, sold it. It was a direct extraction of cultural and economic value, completely bypassing the person and community it came from. That's a textbook unjustified taking.
And this isn't new, right? This pattern of taking, especially from marginalized groups, has a long history. Music comes to mind.
Oh, definitely. The history of blues music in America is, unfortunately, a prime example. You had countless Black artists writing and performing incredible music,
only to see white musicians cover their songs and achieve massive fame and fortune, while the original artists were shut out by racism, denied airplay, royalties, recognition.
Exactly. That wasn't just inspiration, it was systemic exploitation enabled by profound inequality. It was an economic harm, yes, but also a harm to their narrative, their place in cultural history, and unjustified taking on a massive scale.
This harm-based approach is really useful. It moves us beyond just gut feelings to asking why something feels wrong. Let's zoom out a bit. What are the big picture themes we should take away from this framework?
Okay, three things really stand out. First, and maybe most obviously, power relations are crucial. You just can't talk about appropriation meaningfully without acknowledging the backdrop of history, colonialism, racism, ongoing inequalities.
So who is borrowing from whom and what's their relative power fundamentally changes the moral equation.
Absolutely. Second, there's the sacred-secular distinction. This is such a helpful practical tool.
Right, because borrowing a recipe feels totally different from borrowing a sacred symbol.
Exactly. Taking something sacred or deeply spiritual is inherently riskier territory because it touches on the core identity and well-being of a community. The potential for profound offense is much higher. With secular items, the main risk is usually unjustified taking, the exploitation angle.
That makes sense. And the third theme, it's about solutions.
Yeah, it's about institutional responsibility. Bellant and Lennard argue pretty strongly that we can't just rely on individuals to do the right thing.
We need systems in place.
Precisely. Real change requires institutions, museums, universities, fashion houses, tech companies, you name it, to build ethical practices. Things like proper consultation, clear policies on use, benefit sharing agreements, shifting the burden, basically.
Okay. For listeners who like those memorable takeaways, those lines that really crystallize an idea, the book has some great ones. Let's highlight a few core quotes or ideas.
I think the most fundamental one is their main thesis, rephrased slightly. Cultural appropriation isn't wrong in itself. It only becomes wrong when it causes specific, significant harm, like profound offense to identity, or unjustified taking of resources.
That really shifts the focus from the act to the consequence.
It does. And then there's a point about offense itself. Not all offense is created equal. For an offense to be profoundly harmful, it needs to be reasonably seen as an assault on dignity and equal standing.
Which sets a high bar.
Yeah.
It protects against simply shutting down anything that makes someone uncomfortable. It requires more substance.
Right. And finally, their view on solutions is telling. The right response to harmful appropriation is rarely censorship or legal bans. Instead, we should rely on social tools, criticism, education, fostering ethical judgment.
So they're advocating for, like, moral dialogue and social pressure, not necessarily laws.
Yeah, more like cultivating ethical self-governance within creative fields and society generally.
Okay, this is all very clear theoretically.
Yeah.
But how do you, listening right now, actually use this day to day? If you're a creator or even just consuming culture, how can you apply this harm test?
It really comes down to asking those two core questions honestly before you borrow, adapt, or even buy something. First, is this element sacred, spiritual, or tied to deep historical meaning for a specific group? And could my use trivialize or disrespect that? That's the profound offense check.
Okay.
Second, am I potentially profiting from this, or is the company I'm buying from profiting in a way that bypasses or further marginalizes the source community? Is there exploitation happening? That's the unjustified taking check.
That's a very practical filter.
Yep.
And for creative professionals, it suggests a path forward too, right? Like the three R's you mentioned.
Exactly. It points towards research, really understanding the cultural context of what you're inspired by. Then respect, engaging with it in a way that avoids stereotypes and doesn't trivialize its meaning.
And the crucial third one.
Recognition. Which can mean different things, maybe seeking collaboration, maybe ensuring fair compensation or benefit sharing, maybe just clear and prominent attribution. It's about acknowledging the source ethically.
And using this framework gives everyone a shared language, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It moves the public conversation from just yelling appropriation to being able to say, okay, this specific action feels like an unjustified taking because X, Y, and Z.
Precisely. It allows for a more reasoned ethical critique.
You know, what really struck me during this deep dive was how effectively they dismantle that cultural ownership idea. I admit my gut reaction often leans towards thinking culture should own their stuff, but they make such a compelling case for why that's not the most helpful or ethical path.
Yeah, their argument that focusing on harm, on justice, dignity, equality is more productive than trying to draw impossible lines around cultural property is really powerful.
And I think for you, the listener, the big takeaway is that this isn't about building walls between cultures. It's not about saying never borrow.
No, not at all. It's about finding better, more ethical ways to engage, ways that are rooted in respect and fairness, particularly when power dynamics are unequal.
Which brings us to a final thought, something for you to chew on. Ballant and Lenard put a lot of faith in social criticism, public dialogue, as the main way to address harmful appropriation. But we live in an age where online criticism can instantly become, well, a pile-on, public shaming.
That's a really good point.
So the provocative question is, how can you use their own harm framework, that distinction between profound offense and unjustified taking, to think critically about the responses themselves? When does necessary social criticism tip over into something else, maybe into its own form of harm?
That's definitely something worth reflecting on as we all try to navigate these complex cultural exchanges.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.